1935, the Lions win the NFL championship. The Detroit Tigers take the World Series. The Red Wings bring home Lord Stanley's Cup. Joe Louis begins his rise to world domination. This transforms the Motor City into Detroit, City of Champions.
There it is, sticking in the ground. We're playing a little golf. Should be going up with the volume, should be going down with the volume. One of them weeks, man.
Just split the difference, stay right in the middle.
I think we will. We are, just get right up on that bad boy always. And then, gives you more presence.
Yeah, there we go.
It's an important story.
Speak to the listener.
You gotta lean into it. It's Detroit, City of Champions, the podcast. I'm Jamie Flanagan.
Charles Aveson.
And Charles wrote a trilogy of books all about the 1935 year. Every time I tell somebody about that, he's like, he got three books out of that? I go, yeah, he started. He couldn't even write a two-page paper.
Yeah, initially.
And,
We got 77 episodes out of it
so far, and we're still rolling.
I got three books. I mean, we got 77 episodes, and we're going strong still.
And so. The golf club I have is very appropriate
for today.
It's a Walter Hagen stick, a little wooden shaft. People watching on Facebook or YouTube can see those. It's kind of fun.
You can imagine it. It's a golf club.
It's a golf club.
and
it's got a wooden shaft.
And it's got a wooden shaft. What is it? What kind of club is it? It's not a putt. It's a chipper, isn't it? It's some kind of a chipping.
It looks like a
7-iron or something.
I think it's a putter. No, it's a putter. It says putter on the bottom.
Oh, is it?
It does say putter on the bottom.
So you can just imagine, if you will.
Yes.
It is a golf club putter with a yellow shaft, and it says Walter Hagen on it. If you can't see it, that's what you're thinking.
That's what you're missing out.
That's what you're missing out
on. That's the fun that you're missing out on. The other fun you can't see is the fantastic T-shirt I have on.
Yeah,
it's the Detroit City of Champions.
Yeah.
Is that crest? You call that a crest?
Yeah.
That's
coat
the crest.
Coat of arms.
Coat of arms. Yeah. It's the big version of it. Available wearingfunny.com, the City of Champions.
You put the link in the show?
Yeah.
Show links description.
Always, the link's
good.
Always in the show notes. So,
cool.
Wearingfunny.com is, you can grab one of these nifty. I love the U in.
There's a ton of, every single component of
Chris,
that means something. We're going to have Chris on here to really break it down, but every single part of that means something.
You and Chris did an amazing job putting that together.
It's fantastic.
Hats off to Chris, hats off to you, and hats for writing the book and everything, and the Walter Hagen story. We've been talking about Walter, and I said it's appropriate we're talking about the golf clubs, because I'm going to beat myself with a golf club if I don't thank people for listening and ask them to like, subscribe, and leave a comment.
Yeah.
I forget to do that all the time. It's like
we've been getting it, but the first 50 shows we didn't hardly ever do that.
I know.
Now we actually spend some time talking.
Do all those podcast things and all those podcast
like
places.
But the thing is, it helps to remind people, because even when I'm watching something, keeps
the lights on,
because a lot of times they have the little. You know, the little click button at the end where it's almost like a Pavlovian thing where the show will be like, you know, click, click, you know, like on the visual of it. And then you just go, oh, yeah, I got to click. It's not that they don't want to. They just kind of forget. So
click on through to the other side. Join us. And thanks for joining us each and every time. And like I said, yes, I'm going to beat myself with the Walter Hagen Golf Club. And that's kind of where we're leading today. Just becoming more and more famous, one of the biggest athletes in the world at this time.
Huge. Like that's what I really love about this, you know, doing this show, is we can take our time and get through these, you know, these people.
He's an innovator too in the sport.
Like Walter Hagen was professional golf.
Mm-hmm.
To make the comparison between Babe Ruth, like he is the Babe Ruth of golf. That is the probably the most apt comparison. Because there's nobody, you know, Babe Ruth.
Champion beyond champion.
Yeah, and, you know, into golf itself, he may have even been bigger than Babe Ruth.
And popularized it.
Because baseball was already pretty massive when Babe Ruth came along.
Yeah.
Babe Ruth really took it to like sort of like the next level he influenced the game in a profound way.
Yeah.
But Walter Hagen, like, at least they were selling tickets to the games before Babe Ruth came along. You know, before Walter Hagen got there, they weren't even selling gallery tickets for people to watch the game.
It wasn't an option.
It wasn't like
they had low attendance. It's the people that came got to go for free.
Yeah, that's like, yeah, it
if
was
they
just
were
sort
allowed,
of private. Yeah, it
yeah.
was like if they were, it was just private country club, you know, things. They would pass the hat to whatever golfer came through. There was no money in golf.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I mean. Like, he showed people how to make money. He showed these courses in them how to make money. He ushered in. he, you know, this is the guy that made professional golf into an actual legitimate, a sport that actually could support an athlete to pursue it as a legitimate career. And so, yeah, I mean, this is the guy that did it all. I mean, he was, like I say, you could say the most apt comparison is Babe Ruth, but in a lot of ways, I mean, for golf, he was bigger than Babe Ruth for the world of golf. So, I mean, yeah, so every single show we've done has been, I think, some just absolutely incredible things.
Yeah.
And last week was no different. You know, he, we talked about him in the 1920s, and it's like, I still have this amazing visual in my head about, you know, there's like the, whenever you see the Roaring Twenties, you think about the New York experience with the Wall Street, everybody's booming. You think about like the Hollywood, the golden era of Hollywood and all this, the flappers dancing, and then you see even Babe Ruth, like hitting home runs and all that kind of stuff. Like those are the imagery that we see whenever we're talking about, we even see the like gangsters and prohibition and those kind of things. Like those are part of the Roaring Twenties elements. But what I love about the, Hagen is that his experience is the Florida experience.
Yeah.
You know, he's living in this Spanish villa with his new wife down in the middle of the Florida land boom, and he's right at the very center of it. He's telling them where to build a bridge, he didn't even know that the captain of the ship's like, oh, I would build it right over there. And Walter's like, yeah, you should build it there. And then the guy's like, let's build it there. And
Walter's a genius.
And Walter really knows his stuff. That's why I just have this vision in my head, that when they opened, like they brought him down there to be their, as their superstar, because they're trying to sell, they're trying to sell this community to people.
Yeah.
And they're like, Hagen's our guy here at the golf course, and at the opening party, like there's all these super, celebrities there. The fountain has got, the fountain's pouring champagne. Like this is the Roaring Twenties in Florida the Hague saw it. And I just think like, if there was ever like a movie, like if I ever wrote him into the screenplay for the miniseries or whatever, like this is such a major, pivot or component of that story. I just think that it could really show if you were to dive into what the Hague was, it'd be like this little 3 to 5 year stretch of his life that took place in the sort of mid-20s. That's when he's 33 years old in 1926. So he's just right there at this, he's the one of the most famous people in America. And he's just, he knows everybody. Every time he says anything in the book, he's like, oh yeah, I was golfing with I used to golf with Babe Ruth every day. And this was the Babe's weakness was that if the game lasted longer than sort of a baseball game length, which is like an hour and a half, 2 hours, then he just like fell apart.
Yeah.
He's like, otherwise he was great. He's like, no, every single person. And we're going to be talking about today, when he starts the golf equipment company, he's starting the company with two guys, two major league players, John Gansel and Joe Tinker.
Okay.
And Joe Tinker is one of the most, in the early 1900s, one of the most famous ball players in America, baseball players. There was a song made about the Tinker to Evers to Chance. They were three Chicago Cubs infielders. It was a very famous double play combination. Tinker was the shortstop. And so it was Tinker to Evers to Chance. That was the shortstop this double play combination. And there was a song. That team with Joe Tinker beat the Tigers twice in the World Series.
Oh, okay.
When Ty Cobb was in the World Series. And so in 1907, 1908, the Cubs beat the Ty Cobb, and Joe Tinker was their shortstop. Like, he's a super famous guy. And And he's like, yeah, I met up with John Gansel and Joe Tinker, and we decided to start this golf company.
All right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's like whenever he's talking about anybody, he's like, yeah, I reached out to my buddy Joe Tinker, Babe Ruth, or whoever. He's like, for him, it's just kind of like another day,
Because he thought about baseball for a little bit.
Oh, totally.
There was a crossroads for him.
Yeah.
So I always love bringing that picture.
And
up.
Then when the stage where he was going after his the British Open,
right.
He's like, man, I need to make some money. I'm gonna go talk to Jesse Livermore, who's the greatest investor, at the time.
Why not?
The biggest Wall Street guy that there is. He's like, just do what I do, Walter, and you'll make a bunch of money. And he did, and he made a bunch of money. He's like, but of all the people, you're gonna reach out to this guy. That's just the kind of life this guy is living, and it's bigger than life. He's just a massive character. So, Yeah, I mean, that's where we just kind of lead into this, you know, this show. We're going to, you know, go into 1925, and the subject matter is him starting this golf club company.
Okay.
That's where we're going to start. And, you know, so we've already talked about when he was a caddy, how he used to make clubs, used to make a little extra money, you know, being a, you know, as a caddy or even as a club pro, that they used to make golf clubs for people. You know, it wasn't a big...
turn them on the lathe.
Yeah, turn them on the lathe, and they did. You know, they made these clubs for people.
Yeah.
And they, because they were all handmade there at the time. There wasn't a big, huge, you know, catalog for buying a bunch of golf equipment.
Sure.
In 1915, beginning in 1915... he had been using and then also being sponsored by the A.G. Spalding Company. So Spalding. Okay. So, you know, he was basically using Spalding equipment. And then they were, you know, they do give him a little kickback for selling, you know, for having his name on stuff. And then also Spalding would actually send, like, at, you know, if he was doing some exhibition, Hagen's like, oh, I only use Spalding. And then there's the Spalding sales guy right there. And then people would go buy the clubs from Spalding. Like, it wasn't necessarily just a catalog. They would go at the tournaments or whatever and buy the gear right then and there.
Sweet.
And so Hagen estimated at one point that he was bringing them about $9,600 a year.
Jeez.
Just from the sales, like the direct sales at his events that he was at.
He's
like,
1920s money. That's big money.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was like, but in his mind, he's like, he starts saying, I want to do my own company. He's like, I think I'll sell more if my name's on it and the people are buying, instead of just Spalding, random Spalding brand, where they're actually buying Walter Hagen gear, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, this is an era when they're starting to do baseball mitts with people's names on them and stuff, too. So that idea is, you know, the branding a superstar's name on stuff is, you know, becoming a, you know, this is American capitalism, you know? So anyways, he goes to Spalding and says, the way I look at it, I'm bringing you $9,600 with your gear. I think I can do double that for you with my name on it. So it's like, how would you like to handle this portion of my, you know, basically you run the business, I'll have my branding, and you give me $20,000 a year for it. And so, and they were like, and they said, no, they were like, the highest they would go was $12,000. And Hagen was like, it's not worth it. I'm already doing, like, you know, he's already getting around $9,600 or whatever. So he's like, it's not worth it. So he said, no. And then that's why it gives him cause to start his own company.
Okay.
And so he knows these two guys. You mentioned
somebody at Spalding just lost their job.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, they were so big. They were looking at it going, you know, we're doing $9,600 a year right now. We're going to pay him $20,000. We'd have to basically pay back $20,000 before we even begin to make a profit. So to them, it was just a risk reward thing, you know?
Right.
Anyways, I mean, they could go get like Gene Sarazen or something and the next best guy for, you know, get do the same thing. So anyways, so that's when Joe Gansel and Joe Tinker, these guys, they're living in Florida at this point. And then, you know, of course that's where the Hague is. This whole story is all, he's still down in Florida and everything. I mean, this is right about the point where this castle is about to open up, this, you know, on the Pasadena on the Gulf is about to open up.
Right.
You know, what do they call it? The Taylor spelled backwards. Rolliott.
Rolliott.
The Rolliott Hotel is just about to open up. So, yep. I mean, this is 1925. It's just about to open up. So he starts this company. They come up with enough money to, you know, he's making pretty good money at this Rolliott doing what he's doing. So they put all this money into this. And what's kind of interesting is they build this, they get a Longwood, Florida. Actually, the city actually built him a building and also gave him the property for the building.
Dang.
Because they think that, like, oh, Walter Hagen's opening up a factory here. It's going to bring in all kinds of blue-collar jobs.
Sure.
Because the Florida land boom, they're trying to draw people in and build up these communities. So it's like, you know, free land, free property, free. City's going to build you a factory, you know. So,
sweet.
So he, you know, so that's all that worked in his favor. The only problem was, he says right in the book, he said, we made a huge mistake, though, that this area of Florida, this Longwood, is the most moisture rich area in the country. So 11%
dealing with wood.
11% of the air was moisture.
Yeah.
It is the highest 11%. You're basically like swimming through the air, you know, 11%.
Yeah.
So he said, it was the back then they used hickory shafts. And he said what would happen is that everything would be fine where they'd make it in Longwood. But the second they sent the clubs, you know, they fixed the head on the shaft. and then they send them out. And then when they would get to any climate that was even remotely dry, especially like Arizona and all this, he said the heads would like rattle on the club because they weren't tight anymore because wood would shrink. And then he said also the shafts would like get all splintered up like a porcupine, and the guys would get splinters in their hand. They're like, could you imagine getting one of these Walter Hagen clubs and the head splinters. Sucks? The splinters in your hand, the head barely doesn't even attach. You're going, these things are junk, you
know? Dang it, Walter.
Yeah. So the thing is, it took him time to realize that, you know, they're printing, they're making hundreds and thousands of clubs, rolling them off the assembly line. And they're shipping them out, and by the time it takes for people to actually complain and all this, by the time the feedback's coming back, he's got to make new clubs, figure out the resolution, all this different stuff. And by that point, the company's now like, I mean, how do you overcome that?
No, there is no overcoming it.
There is no overcoming it, not from making it in Longwood. It's just that's the way that it is. And so as a result, this company just starts to hemorrhage cash. Hemorrhage. So basically all the money he's making as, you know, having this really great job in Florida – He says, like clockwork, every single Friday, my bills every Friday were about $5,000. He said, all I was doing was just writing $5,000 checks every week.
Dang.
Coming right out of his money he was making from the Roliot. And then he's just, here you go. Every week, he said, there was another $5,000. He said, it got to the point where he was in $200,000 of debt by 1925.
Dang.
So you can think of right around 1922, 23 is when he starts the company up. So a little bit, you know, about 2 years, he's $200,000 in debt from this company. So he's like, I'm basically going to have to play golf for the rest of my life to pay this bill.
Yeah.
Right? And so anyways, so he reaches out to his friend Al Wallace. And so this guy, Al Wallace, I don't know if we've noticed here, but this guy, Al Wallace, is the guy who got him into Oakland Hills Country Club originally. This is the guy that he was playing, like he bet on Walter Hagen, and Hagen was like making him sweat a little bit because he knew he was going to win the money for him. But Al Wallace is the guy that basically recruited Hagen to be Oakland Hills' first club professional. And so since that day, Al Wallace, throughout this entire book, has popped up probably 10 different times. So whenever he gets in trouble, he's like, hey, Al, you know, I need some help.
Well, that's like $3.4 million.
Yeah.
It was about $3.4 million in debt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In today's
money. But what's funny is every time he gets in trouble, he reaches out to Al Wallace. Hey, Al, man, I'm in trouble. It's always a different, because I think it was Al Wallace that directed him to Wall Street guys with the, you know,
hey, got any more of them Wall Street fellas kicking around?
Exactly. So it's like, but the problems are always different. They always seem to be different.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll go through and put together a collection of all the different things that Al Wallace helped him out of, because there's all these different, he's like, Al, I need some help. You know, Al's just like this kind of plugged in industrialist in Detroit, and he's like, man, I need some help. And then so Al Wallace sets him up with this Detroit, like they call him a financier named L.A. Young.
Okay.
And so L.A. Young basically L.A. Young, he's not really interested in the business. He's just interested in Walter Hagen. He likes this guy's trying to like get to know people. He knows that Hagen is massively plugged in. And if he's plugged in with Hagen, then he's going to be plugged in with a bunch of other people too. So that's kind of his motive. And Hagen even admits that. He's like, he knows that I knew everybody, and then he was going to be the guy that helps, you know, get, you know, that he's going to plug in with me. So he's like, he goes, I was fine with that because I was in so much trouble. You know, I needed somebody to help me bail out. So he did. And so L.A. Young buys this company. He gives Hagen $75,000 and then takes over all the debt and owns the company now. And so Hagen becomes the director of engineering for the company. So, which is a perfect thing, because now Hagen just gets to help design the clubs and tinker around with get the best shaft. So L.A. Young moves the company to Detroit first, and then they move it to Grand Rapids second. And that's where it stays in Grand Rapids for some time. We have a little graphic that shows the advertisement.
Yeah, I have the club stuff up there.
Yeah. This is a little advertisement. And what's funny is at the bottom of the graphic, it says, kind of small, but I'll read it off. I have it on my phone. I'm going to read it off. And the bottom of the phone, of the graphic, it says, don't think just because you own a set of Hague Ultra clubs, you're going to play as good a game as the great Walter Hagen. That's their ad. don't think just because you own a set of Ultra Clubs, you're going to play as good as a Great Hagen. Like, that's like usually that's actually the reverse of the pitch.
Right,
usually the pitch is get a set of these clubs, you'll be just like the Hagen. It's like reverse psychology.
You're like, I
don't
can't,
think you're going to.
It's golf. They're realists, man. They're like, I can't tell you how many times my dad bought a club. He's like, this damn thing doesn't work.
I'm taking it back. Hey, this thing you said I was going to play like Hagen. Like, no, we didn't. It says the opposite on the ad. We said right there very clearly you're not going to be able to play as good as Hagen.
I love it.
So anyways, this is a great little ad. It's got a rotogravure of Walter Hagen in the background too, which is really cool.
Yeah.
So, and it's just a shout out. It's a rotogravure, which is like a sepia tone color. Those are like the most high quality images known to man. They used to put them out in Sunday papers back in the early in the 20s and 30s.
Okay.
Yep. And so, they have this really nice. It's a young Walter Hagen too. He's kind of thin. Picture Walter Hagen. So, anyways, so he becomes this director of engineering, and. I have a cool little short quote here about Hagen, how he talked about like his, once the LA took over, LA Young took over it, how it kind of changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, I drew no salary after LA took over. I never got my hand in the till because I wasn't looking for that kind of small stuff. I preferred his signature on a check. There were sessions between us when he swore he would never sign another check for me, but he paid and paid and paid. He tried to instill in me a reasonable pattern of economy, but I was completely immune to any such foolish suggestions. As long as I kept playing in competition and winning the championship, I saw no need to cut down on my mode of living. I needed to go first class. I was the front for the company, and L.A. recognized that, although he was also convinced it could be accomplished without the enthusiastic exuberance I devoted to it.
Enthusiastic exuberance.
He's highly intelligent with our business association was one of the wildest financial merry-go-rounds in history, but it resulted in security for me and a profit for L.A. Young, and it came about through another first for me. I was the first golfer to manufacture golf equipment on a production basis.
Hey.
Another first. But I love how he's going... he says it in this like
exuberant
super highly intelligent way to say he likes to spend money and he likes to live like a hog in a fat house. He's like, I have an exuberant way that I like to live. I love what he says. He tried to instill in me a reasonable pattern of economy, but I was quite immune to any such foolish suggestions.
Foolish.
He says he's got the greatest sense of humor.
He's like,
he's got somebody else actually hitting the keyboard, on a typewriter to write this book. But you know that there's that flair of Hagen right there that's coming out, that's going right through the typewriter girl or whoever's just probably cracking up going. He's like, but you know that I was immune to such foolish suggestions. That's got to be
his voice.
So anyway, so that's kind of a wrap on that. But so that company ended up in 1944. He actually talks about in the book. In 1944, L.A. Young sold the business to Wilson, Wilson Sports, and then the company became volleyball's Wilson. Yeah. So Walter Hagen. So the company became the Walter Hagen division of the Wilson Sporting Goods Company.
All right.
And then now I just did a quick, kind of a Google search for just like Walter Hagen, whatever. And I saw Dick's Sporting Goods had an entire line of Walter Hagen clothes and stuff. So it looks like it's been sold from Wilson to Dick's, or maybe it's kind of a line or whatever, something like that. Yeah. So anyways, that's a wrap kind of on that. But, on his Hagen Golf Club Company. And so that was 1925.
Right.
And now we're getting into sort of the main subject of this episode, which the title kind of conveys, the match of the century.
The match.
You don't have the echo. You don't have the echo. You can't hit me with the echo, can you?
Oh, you're
for that one second, Jenny. Hit me with the echo.
Give me 2 seconds here.
We'll switch right back.
All right.
The match of the century. Come on.
I'm trying. Hang on.
I feel like a jerk.
Go, go.
The match of the century.
There it is. That's silly, silly,
Thank
silly
you.
Business.
That's all I needed
it
for. That's a little more hype, I think.
It is.
We got a little production value out of that. Because I knew that would come in handy. So anyways, 1926. So we're heading to 1926. In order to talk about this next bit, we have to talk about one of the most ultimate legends in golfing history, which is Bobby Jones. Okay, now we're into the Bobby Jones, you know, all that sort of Bobby Jones stuff.
Right.
And which is like one of the things that a lot of times when Walter Hagen is mentioned, it's mentioned in with a sort of tandem with these matches with Bobby Jones. Because,
right.
And so especially, you know, if we're talking like the legend of Bagger Vance.
Yeah.
He's got this, you know, we've seen that, I watched a clip today with it. You know, and the characters that play Bobby Jones and Walter Hagen are just unbelievable.
Yeah.
They're just totally, I mean, they're so phenomenal.
Yeah.
And so anyways, you know, there's, so if you haven't seen Legend of Bagger Vance, or even if you have, it's worth revisiting because those guys, I think those guys nail it. And in the way they talk, they show Hagen like sitting in a bar drinking. He's like, you know, kind of, you know, casual and laughing and just got all these stories and stuff. I think they do a really good job capturing those two characters. But again, whenever we, you know, like the name Hagen in a lot of ways has come down in its attachment to Bobby Jones. And so that's, you know, so and this right now was when this, you know, this attachment begins because of this match of the century, which is what. And so the sort of background of this 1926 event was just the dominance of these two players.
Okay.
And so Walter Hagen, so especially like, you know, we already know about the stuff Walter Hagen's been doing all the way up to this point, but Bobby Jones is an amateur. He's only 23 years old. Hagen's 33 years old, but Bobby Jones is coming out at just winning everything in his path. And so in 1925, Walter Hagen wins the second of four straight PGA championships. Of course, he's coming off a British Open. He's coming off of all these other championships and tournaments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Bobby Jones, in 1925, he wins his second straight USGA amateur title, and then he wins the 1923 U.S. Open.
Uh-oh.
So, he had won the 1923 U.S. Open, and then he would go on in 1926 to win the U.S. Open and then the British Open. And then he ends up winning four U.S. Opens, three British Opens. This guy, you know, Bobby Jones is a legend. He's got, you know, they're one of the great debates is who is the better golfer, you know, between Hagen and Bobby Jones. And even Hagen addresses that. He talks about it. He's like, it's enough that we're both phenomenal. Like, I don't want to say who's better. And so, but what they really, in 1925, which again, this is the year we're talking about, 25 going into 1926, Bobby Jones is so phenomenal that he's on the cover of Time magazine in August, which is, we have a graphic for right here.
Yeah.
So that's the cover that he's on for Time magazine. He's 23 years old. He is the face, you know, as much as Walter Hagen is dominant, it's strange because Bobby Jones actually becomes like the face of golfing.
Mm-hmm.
Where Babe Ruth is, they call him the five giants of the 1920s sports scene, which is Babe Ruth, Jack Dempsey, Red Grange, Bill Tilden, and then Bobby Jones. But Walter Hagen is not sort of on that list of these five greats. Because Bobby's this young, good-looking, you know, just total, like, young superstar coming out of nowhere. And so they're all sitting, now they're like, here's this up-and-coming superstar, this prodigy of golf. And like, you know, Hagen is sort of the former prodigy, you know, he's the guy like the aging great or whatever you want to call him. So who's better? This idea, who's the better golfer, Bobby Jones or Walter Hagen, just the conversation just starts to heat up and it just starts to grow and grow and grow and grow. And it just gets to the point where, like, they just have to play a game. They have to play a match game, not, like, a big tournament. Because they'd already faced each other in a couple tournaments, but that wasn't satisfying. That wasn't satisfying the public demand for a mano-a-mano match, you know, match game against these two. And so they decide. And so, but Hagen talks about it in the book, and he said, I have nothing to gain from this.
Yeah.
What do I have to gain? I'm the peak of my profession. I'm going against an amateur who, like, if he wins and beats me, then everybody's going to be like, well, amateur is, once again, the purest form of golf, and they have their amateurism is the better version of golf. And he's saying, you know, he's like, I have everything to lose and nothing to gain, because if I beat him, I'm just going to reinforce the idea that I'm, like, the best one out there.
Right.
He's like, if Bobby Jones wins, he has everything to gain and nothing to lose, because he's going to be like, he just dethroned the great Walter Hagen, and, you know, he's the biggest rising up-and-comer, and I'm going to be kicked into the dirt and be just like some other guy that's, you know, trying to chase after Bobby Jones, you know?
Yeah.
So he's like, I have nothing to gain. So he had no interest whatsoever in this tournament, in doing a match tournament. But the public demand is growing so loud, can't ignore it anymore. Yeah. And so that debate, it's not like it just like out of nowhere 1925 happened. It had been growing for some time, but in 1925, it ratcheted up to such a fever pitch that he just has to
can't say no.
Yeah, he can't say no. And so what's interesting is Bobby Jones is also, you know, he's not a professional, so he doesn't take wages for it, but he's got this weird connection to another club down in Florida called Whitfield Estates. And so he, which is in Sarasota. So that's like kind of his home club. I don't think he's drawn revenue off of like golf there, but for some reason they called it his home club. Like he was there all the time. So anyways, they agreed to a home and home tournament, a home and home match tournament. So it would be 36 holes at one guy's course, one on a Sunday, and then 36 holes at the other guy's, which meaning they're going over to, the Pasadena, you know, the Rolliott, you know, courses.
All right.
And for the following Sunday, for the last 36 holes, okay. You know, they're going to play, you know, either side. And so so the match tournament's a little bit different than
that's
just
fair.
A regular thing, because it's all about who wins each hole.
Okay.
It's not about like what your score is. It's about who wins. Whoever has a lower score on that hole, you get 1 point. Whoever has a lower score in the next hole, that person gets the point. Mm-hmm, and so on and so forth until whoever has the
most
points.
Because you could blow a hole.
Yeah, but if you're better than the other guy, still you win.
And yeah.
It doesn't carry over
to the
next.
But if you blow a hole, you like 7-stroke a hole, and the other guy, you know, threes, you only lose 1 point.
1 point, yeah, because you just lost the hole. Then you start from scratch in the next hole.
Yeah.
And it took me a second to figure that out because we'll see in a second. It was just kind of a weird score. And so I'm like, what is – it didn't make sense to me. I thought they got mercied or something, because I'm like, why did they finish? Like, they didn't finish all the holes or whatever. But anyways, they agreed to this situation, right? They agreed to this thing. And so Hagen knew that Bobby Jones had never played on his course on the Rolliott. So he wanted to let Bobby play. So they agreed to have this like sort of foursome exhibition, like an exhibition before this match of the century. And so it leads to this strange story, which is I think really, you know, it's central to the story. And what it is that Hagen's sick. Hagen is sick leading up to this exhibition, and in his words is far better than I can do justice to it.
Sure.
I think it's as usual, the Hague has got some interesting.
And all like so much of this information. Well, all this information is right out of his book, The Walter Hagen Story.
Yeah. Yeah, so
by the Hague himself.
Yeah, so all right, so he says, so this is Hagen, and again, this isn't the game of the century like we're talking about. This is the prior to it, as they're
right.
he's just going to go out and practice with Bobby Jones and these other two guys.
Sure.
So he says, however, for all of our plans, the match almost didn't come off. 2 weeks before the date of the four-ball match, I came down with the flu. The epidemic was quite widespread, and I spent the time in bed with a physician in attendance. In fact, on the morning of the match, I had a temperature of 102 degrees. My doctor flatly refused to approve my playing 36 holes of golf. Doc telephoned Bobby's hotel and asked that he or one of his party come over to my house to verify my condition. Perhaps Bobby suspected this bit of business was some additional skullduggery on my part, some smart trickery designed to upset him. I'd never been ill since that lobster and oyster tow mine upset in Chicago in 1914. Writers dubbed me Iron Man Hagen and other such colorful tabs to indicate my ability to resist the common ills of humanity. How could Hagen be sick? I imagine some of those things were in Bobby's mind, for he informed my doctor, if Hagen isn't on the first tee in an hour, there'll be no match between us. We'll go back home. I insisted on getting out of the bed and playing in the foursome, and Doc finally agreed I could start, providing I got no worse as the match progressed. Doc, I said, you go around the course with me and take my temperature. He got me a pith helmet and lined it with huge leaves from a plant in Taylor's nursery. He must have used leaves from a rubber plant, for my ball acquired some much-needed elasticity and liveliness, a requisite made necessary by the physical weakness with which the flu had left me. My temperature was still 102 when I stepped up to the first tee. Bobby was openly skeptical, but by the time we reached the eighth hole, he realized I was a truly sick man. And then, gentlemen, that he has always been, he came over and apologized for his earlier attitude. He and Tommy Armour beat Gil Nichols and me 4-3, and I shook hands with no one. Simply turned my back on them all, jumped into my car, and headed for home in bed. The Jones-Hagen match took place 2 weeks later. By then, I was fully recovered from my illness, and I was determined to give him the beating of his life. His skepticism had spurred me into a will to win, which otherwise might have been much less keen. So he was pissed.
Well, yeah, I mean, you didn't have to let him practice at his club.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he's trying to be nice, and he's going to say, oh, I'm not going to even
I can't make it. You guys go do a round, but I won't make it.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not even going to show. But he's even saying, you're not even going to show up to the main match of the century because I'm sick right now.
Yeah.
What kind of trick could I be playing? That's why Hagen's like, what are you talking about? You know, Hagen was legendary for his tricks and all this kind of stuff, you know, so that's fair play. But at the same time, like, what would be his motivation for not showing up to the game, you know, for the match? And that's what he's saying. He's like, what are you talking about, dude? I'm sick as a dog.
Mm.
And he's like, well, I'm just going to go home and I'll take my clubs with me, you know? And he goes, well, then screw you. I'm going to beat the crap out of you. He even says it. He goes, he's like, I'm going to give him the beating of his life. So anyways, do you want to guess what happens next?
Oh. Hagen falls apart and has some wicked, awful shots.
Wrong. So anyways.
Could have gone either way.
No, wrong.
Okay.
So I was doing a little bit of a Google search because Hagen spends the next like 8 pages talking about this. And I was just doing a little bit of side reading today and I found this really great, this is like one of the first sources we're using outside of the Hagen, but I read it and I, you know, after reading the book, this is a fantastic little quick summary. And the guy does a really good job.
All right. Of this match.
Yeah, and it's a paper from the year 2000. It is by a gentleman.
He sat on that story for a while.
What's that? Oh no, this guy's writing a paper for Olivet Nazarene University.
Yeah,
you got it. You hit it. You did great. Keep going.
Just pay no mind to me. Just keep going.
So the gentleman who wrote this paper's name is Stephen Lowe. And it was published in 2000 on Olivet Nazarene University. It was the year 2000. And the title of the article is Sir Walter and Mr. Jones, Walter Hagen, Bobby Jones, and the Rise of American Golf, Prologue. Mm. So I think he did a fantastic job, like, sort of summarizing, like, you know, because it, like, again, Hagen's thing is very long. And this is a very good, quick summary. Yeah, it's a quick summary about how the tournament played out, how this two-game tournament played out. And so he begins saying, they seemed nervous in the early holes, but Hagen settled himself more quickly than Jones, particularly on the green. We're talking about the first 36 holes now at Whitfield Estates on February 28th, 1926. They seemed nervous in the early holes, but Hagen settled himself more quickly than Jones, particularly on the greens, and grabbed a three up lead by lunch break. Nothing changed to the first 5 holes of the afternoon. As the pair teed off on the par 4 sixth, Jones planned to build some momentum going into the last 9 of the day. Both men hit solid drives, but while Jones was down the middle, Hagen bounded toward the rough. Jones hit his approach to within 12 feet of the flag. At that point, with Hagen's ball in a tricky lie behind a pine tree, it looked like a win for the amateur. Then came the turning point. Jones had watched Hagen crouch low over his ball, examine his lie, the pine tree, and his difficult path to the green. He saw Hagen smile when he went to his bag and talked to his caddy. And, like everyone else, in the silence, he fixed his gaze on Hagen as he began his backswing. Sir Walter had decided to reach the green by slicing a mid-iron shot around the tree, but the stroke did not come off as planned. Instead, he completely mishit the ball, topping it so that it took off under the tree branches. To everyone's amazement, the ball carried down the fairway, through a bunker, up a bank that guarded the front of the green, and finally rested about 10 feet from the flag. Now Jones was under pressure to make his 12-footer. His putt rimmed the cup but stayed out. Hagen then delicately rolled his ball into the hole for a birdie 3. And rather than trailing by only 2, Jones was again 4 down. Jones later told his biographer, O.B. Keeler, I watched that shot from the rough, and I said to myself, I'm 4 down to a man who can miss one like that? When a man misses his drive and then misses his second shot and then wins the hole with a birdie, it gets my goat. It was the kind of performance which had caused Lou Daigle to remark after losing to Hagen in a 1925 PGA match, I never want to play him again. He's killing me. As they made the final turn, Hagen went on the offensive shooting for birdies. The strategy paid off, and he started a run that all but finished Jones. The Atlantan played the last 9 in a solid 36, but Hagen scorched it in 32, minus 4. After the first day, Hagen was 8 up. Hagen was 8 holes up after the first day.
That's Walter Goff right
but
there.
That's what
man.
He said. They're like, what
that's,
the hell?
That's Walter Goff.
He missed his first two shots.
That's it. Yeah.
And still that's what, got a birdie.
Yeah. So I was expecting the bad shots and not recovering. He did the,
yeah,
the,
he's
the classic, classic
yeah, he
Hagen
is.
And the horrible shots. And
yeah.
Then,
no, yeah. He, yeah. So anyway, so Hagen's got another section that kind of talks about, again, like how he viewed
but
Bobby Jones.
It took
Jones's,
him 8 pages to do that.
Yeah. So, yeah. But, so that's what I'm saying. He had a really great little summary there. And so, you can find that article very easy if you type in 1926, you know, Hagen versus Jones. That's one of the first articles that pops up on a Google search. So this is a great little section, just a quick paragraph talking about, because Hagen kind of reinforces Bobby Jones's style versus his own. And there's trials and tribulations with either their style, but he talks about, you know, the differences in his own words. So he says, Bobby Jones always played precision golf. Every shot had to be perfect. If he could not win, at least his game was so consistent that he finished well up front. To me, finishing well up meant nothing. I played to win. I've always been willing to gamble away a second or third place to try a seemingly impossible shot that would bring me in first. Bobby Jones and winning that challenge match was equally important to both Bobby Jones and to me, and certainly we each went into it determined to give it all we had in skill and experience. Okay, that was a little verbal, but anyways,
yeah.
So you can see he's like Bobby Jones, and they kind of show that in that same concept in Bagger Vance. Because Bobby Jones is like a technician. Like, he's like perfect on every single shot.
Yeah, yeah.
But he might be perfect on every single shot, but it's not necessarily going to get him the best scores every single time. Whereas Hagen's going for the gold like every single time. He's like, I'm willing to risk it. I mean, we've seen a couple of tournaments where Hagen got destroyed because he's trying to do too much or makes a bad shot. But he's like, you know, he's like, I'm going for gold every single time. And that's what ended up happening in this. Hagen's like trapped under a tree or whatever, and he drives a shot that ricochets off a branch and then off a tree limb that banks onto the off the pebble on the edge of the
sand
trap.
The ball and it spins all the way up there.
It's like a putt-putt golfing thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway,
right,
then
off the clown's
and then he's
nose.
And then the worst thing is that he's a phenomenal putter.
Yeah.
So he just destroys on the putter. Once it gets anywhere near the green, he's dropping it. Everybody's going, "What the hell is going on?"
Yeah.
You know, he's just killing people. So Hagen, just to kind of pick up on it, so Hagen finishes the first game 8 ahead of Jones, and then in the second, in this we actually have a picture of a postcard, which is them when they get and then so the next Sunday he ends up they end up back at that at the Rolliot for that next Sunday. That's what's so cool. This postcard, If you type in on a Google search, I just found this on a Google search. You type in Bobby Jones versus Hagen, that's what's cool. I was hoping you were going to bring the last week's picture up.
Yeah.
Because it shows the Rolliot Hotel
you can see
in the background.
Because we were talking about that all last week.
That is the coolest thing in the world, man.
And then
the
postcard about the game.
He's got the distinctive roof.
Yeah.
And it's got in the background of this, you know, the great, you know, the match of the century.
Match of the century.
Yeah, it's got it in the background of that postcard, you know. So it's just super. When I saw it, I was like, that's the Rolliot.
All
I
right,
can tell
it
now
again.
You know, the match of the, come on, Jamie.
I thought I had it in there.
You gotta set me up like that.
I did. All right, do it again now.
The match of the century.
There it is.
So that's that. So it's got that Rolliot in the background. So when I saw that poster, I was like, "That's coming."
What are we,
with
Channel
me.
62?
Yeah.
All right.
But I saw that poster. I'm like that postcard is going to be shown because we have all the postcards from last week. And I'm like, it's got the Rolliot in the background. So anyways, Hagen wraps. So the second day, Hagen wraps it up. I mean, he wins with 11 holes to play in the Rolliot Hotel, whatever. With 11 holes to play, he wins.
Jeez.
So that's how much he destroyed Bobby Jones on this game. So it was over. They still played the last 11.
Because
just
I could
for the
phone this
it.
In now.
Yeah. So the way they describe it is, it was.
It was probably fun for Walter. It probably was not fun for Jones having to limp on in.
Yeah.
Hagen
says this was one of the best putting days he's ever had in his life. He says of any day he's ever had. Yeah. He's like,
Chevy Chase hitting those balls.
Yeah. He's like, yeah. He's like, I could not miss. That's what he was saying. Yeah. And so he's like, I destroyed Bobby Jones in this tournament. And so that's the thing is, like, going in, everybody's like, who's the best golfer that there is? And this didn't necessarily solve that issue because Bobby Jones is going to go on to keep on just – I mean, there was many other tournaments that they face each other.
Yeah.
Bobby Jones would win some. Hagen would win some. You know, they just – you know, but from here on out, they were going to be – it was a constant discussion, especially when they were at the tournaments. It was a storyline for golf to follow with the rest as long as Hagen would continue to play. Was just how much better, you know, who was the better golfer, and so the, you know that he's kind of like the you know two competitors here, so he beats Bobby Jones, and then what's kind of interesting is Hagen wins $7,600, which is the largest purse ever won in an exhibition tournament.
Oh, okay,
yeah, $7,600. Right. But here's the thing: Bobby Jones didn't get anything because he was an amateur.
Ah.
He can't get paid, right? And so what Hagen does,
Hagen's caddy probably made more.
Probably, but actually what ended up happening was Hagen bought a platinum and diamond set of platinum and diamond cufflinks and gave them to Bobby Jones as a gift. It cost him $800.
Yeah, all right.
So that's how he kicked a little to Bobby Jones.
Sure.
He's like, here, Bobby, take these.
I got some cufflinks.
Platinum and diamond. Like that's
they
class.
Got my initials in number one on it.
that'd be so awesome.
WH number one. Yeah. Hey, how about these cufflinks?
Yeah, he's like, check this out, WH number one. Hey, you got those cufflinks on, Bobby? Those look really good on you.
That would be classic Walter. That would be
totally. And so so there's sort of a postscript by Walter where he says where he talks about, like, you know, the postscript for this tournament. He said what did that one man-to-man match between Bobby in 1926 prove? Well, the closest I can come to an answer is that any champion golfer with his nerve steady, his game at its peak, the weather and course conditions equalized by his skill and luck, can beat any other champion golfer on any given day. I happened to play Bobby on my particular days, and I'm certainly convinced that my putting gave me the big break in that match. As for putting, as far as I know, I'm the only golfer to have had the rather incredible achievement of using only 7 putts for 9 consecutive holes.
Wow.
I hold long putts on 7 holes and chipped in from the green on the other 2. With that record to ponder, I believe a break for the 19th hole is in order.
I think it's time for cocktails.
Yes.
That's classic Walter.
That's but he still had
nine putts.
What do you say? Seven putts on nine holes. Seven putts.
Because 2 of them he chipped in from the fringe.
Yeah, 7 putts on 9 holes, dude. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
7 putts.
That's monstrous.
That's insane.
That's
how good of a putter he
was.
That is the best
putting day ever.
So that's what I'm saying. That's when you have that kind of skill in your putting.
Yeah.
That's when you know that all you got to do is get to the green. And you are knocking it down. And that's probably what was just killing people is they're like, he just gets on the green and knocks it in.
Might be ugly on the way there.
Yeah, but once he gets on the green. But that's
pretty for the close-up.
But that's what also make a phenomenal movie, you know, miniseries component with Walter Hagen. Imagine showing this kind of golfer, you know, where he's just money once he gets on the green. Like, money, dude. Yeah. One shot, just an assassin
and
from anywhere.
And he's shankopotamus off the tee.
Yeah. Terrible off the tee. Driving it into the sand, kicking it off. Got to hit it off of somebody's shoe or something.
All right, shankopotamus.
Yeah, and then he just bangs it onto the green somehow, and then he's just dropping it for a birdie. They're like, what the hell just happened? I'm just about to win the tournament. He just killed me.
So this was in the end of 25 and into 26.
Well, no, it's 1926. The tournament happens in over the court between February 28th, 1926, and then the following Sunday, whatever day it was, like October 4th or whatever.
So that's beginning of the year. All right, yeah.
Yeah, beginning of the year, right. 1926. It kind of carried, you know, they're down in Florida as well.
Yeah,
so it's, you know, they're down in the, you know, hot, you know, getting away from the winters, northern winters and stuff.
I was just talking to my mom today. It's mid-October when we're recording this, and it's like 85 down there. So.
Yeah.
It's brilliant golf weather. It's like, you brat.
Yeah. So you're seeing, like, you know, this is it's in 1925, 26, the middle of this Florida land boom.
Yeah.
Bobby Jones and Hagen, they're having these golf tournaments. I mean, like, this is their life, man. And it's, you know, this, like saying this, you know, it's with Bobby Jones, this is where that sort of rivalry or whatever, you know, however you want to describe it, this is where it begins.
So this is the Rolyat, which is the Pasadena of Florida, or is it in Pasadena?
Pasadena on the Gulf.
That's
what they called the area,
right,
yeah.
Pasadena on the Gulf.
Yeah, now it's called St. Petersburg.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, all right, yeah. That's a great area. But is he the pro at Oakland Hills currently?
Well, years,
but he's affiliated. He
drifted away from that. He couldn't be tied down, as you can see.
Yeah,
he was so on the go. But at the same time, you could see the Detroit connections remain.
Yeah,
Al Wallace is coming there. He's moving his company to Detroit. You know, like, he's got these massive Detroit connections still.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, in a lot of ways, the Detroit connections are what really opened up the business world for him. That's where he met a lot of these people that he would have never met otherwise. You know, he was meeting all kinds of sports stars.
Yeah,
but you're not going to Babe Ruth to help you finance something.
No.
You know what I mean? You're going to Babe Ruth to play golf and go get some drinks afterwards. That's what I'm saying. So
Babe Ruth's for the photo op.
Yeah. So Detroit is where he got a lot of his financier type connections that bailed him out numerously, you know, like when he tries to become a broker on Wall Street, and then he's like, oh man, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And he's like,
so was the Ryder Cup, right? Is it
that's
the,
coming? Yeah,
the Ryder, was it a thing yet? When did the Ryder Cup start?
No, it's not yet. That's going to be born out of these competitions with Britain at these British Opens.
All right.
Where these, you know, how we had, remember how we introduced the show? The first we're talking about how there's the British invasion of America,
yeah,
and then there's the American invasion of Britain after World War I. They call it the American invasion, right? And so there's like, they, instead of calling it the invasions anymore, they're recognizing that both sides of the Atlantic both have skill. And so why not just institutionalize it and make it a battle of countries? And,
all right, 1927 was the first one, so we're still 2 years out
from
the
first. Yeah, we're getting there.
Ryder Cup that happens.
Yeah, so
okay.
Yeah, we're getting there. And so, but here's the thing, is that the reason why Hagen is going to be the captain of that Ryder Cup team is because he excels at these match play tournaments, and that's what the Ryder Cup format is going to be.
Okay.
I believe it's five men, and it's going to be like a five-man match tournament between the other side, and it's going to be a national thing. So it's going to be, you know, America versus, you know, Great Britain. You know, it's going to be a match tournament.
Play at Worcestershire sauce.
Yeah.
Country club.
Well, the 35 one's going to be in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And so, but Hagen's going to captain this team because he's such a, you know, he's like the best match player. Nobody wants to play him in a match tournament because he's just, he's like the most, he's like a psychologist, man. He just tears people up. So,
all right.
So that's where we're heading, and that's, you know, that's, but that idea for, you know, there's, you know, there's a bunch of circumstances are going to lead to that Ryder Cup.
Because we talk about Detroit City Champions. I'm just trying to maintain that
redirect. But you see, like, Walter. Al Wallace comes through from Detroit. There's all kinds of little things.
If down in Florida, I mean, that part of Florida, Edison is down there.
Yeah.
And Henry Ford is down there. I mean, there's a huge Detroit money thinkers, innovators, contingency down there in Florida around this time.
Yeah.
The mansions are still there. They're gorgeous to see.
Yeah, there's that's what I'm saying. Like, when he went down there originally, it was, I'm trying to see who was the guy that brought him down there originally, but I think the guy that originally turned him onto that area was a Detroiter.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I'm saying. He's got numerous, you know, when they moved the business, they moved it to Detroit. Mm-hmm. You know, this is where he's got, you know, Hagen's all over the world. You know, he's in India, he's in Japan, and he's all over the place. But Detroit is the, you know, that's like his sort of like, you know, financier connection zone, you know. And he, of course, you know, he's even said, we even talked about it, like the Detroit Athletic Club was the building he was more familiar with than any other building in the world.
Yeah.
He said.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a wedding coming up there in a couple of weeks.
Well, so for him to say that, that's in, you know, if he has anywhere to call home, as much of an itinerant, like, sort of traveler as he is, the fact that he would single out Detroit is that if there was a home, then this is going to be it. You know,
that's one of my laments is I never got to play at DJ or work a gig as an entertainer at Oakland Hills.
Oh, yeah. I got a chance. I did art shows there. I did like three. It was like 3 years I did art shows there.
Yeah, it's because it's nice. My dad
was
a drummer.
Yeah,
and he played the country club circuit. You know, so he played, you know, Oakland Hills and the Red Run and all those Oakland County courses, the Tam O'Shanter, you know, all the fancy pants places over there. And, you know, it's I've played all of them. I've done them all.
Yeah.
You know, from the Rooster Tail on up to Pine Knob and everything in between.
Well, the course itself didn't burn.
No, I know. No, but I'm just talking about doing the entertainment.
Doing the DJ thing there.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, I've been there. I did it.
I got a Masonic Temple coming up, and I got a Detroit Athletic.
Oh, you got
Athletic.
A Masonic Temple? I live right down the street from there, man. I've had a chance. I got a tour one time through there. We identified the room that the City of Champions banquet was in.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we went in there into the room. It was I forgot the exact name of it. It's
Do you have it written down somewhere? You got to tell me so I can when I go
it
there.
It might even be the room you do. I mean, it's a big celebration hall, but that building is ridiculously huge.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many parts.
We got
to
look a little bit in their archives too. They do
roller derby in the basement.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's nuts. So.
No, that's one thing I've never watched before, but would be interested in going to see as a roller derby thing.
It is. It's kooky. All right, man.
Kind of interesting.
Cool. I love doing the show, man. Yeah. I love telling these stories.
No,
I love hearing you unwrap this for us. So.
No, I love it too because we get to just like I say, we get to unwrap these whenever you know. Like Walter Hagen is one of these characters that he's never unwrapped. Where do you ever see him? There's no movie on Walter. I mean, he pops up in the Bagger Vance or whatever. Mm-hmm. But again, a lot of times when you see Walter Hagen, it's in conjunction with Bobby Jones.
Yeah.
You know, again, in Bagger Vance, that was the case. Whenever you hear his name, it's usually in referral to, like, this 1926 match of the century or something.
I just giggle every time anybody ever says Bagger Vance, just because all I hear is Shia LaBeouf saying, "We're not making effing Bagger Vance."
Oh, yeah, you told us that story. Yeah.
I just saw that's all I hear.
You asked if they'd golf there themselves or whatever.
Yeah, because he did the greatest game ever played.
Yeah.
And we asked my students were interviewing him, and they asked him, so how much did you practice? How much golf? How much did you guys have to learn the game? He's like, "We're not making fucking Bagger Vance here."
Yeah, we actually did take our shots.
Yeah, we did. We're like, all right,
do it.
It was way before do it.
So he's always tied to Jones. It's always this Bobby Jones Hagen, attachment. And that's what I mean. That's why I'm glad that we get to actually, we did 11 episodes before we even mentioned Bobby Jones.
Right. Yeah.
So he's already a legend by the time this, to him, he didn't even want to do this. This wasn't even worth his time originally.
Yeah. Yeah.
He wasn't even from his perspective, he liked Bobby Jones. He was friends with him. He respected him. But Bobby Jones, in his mind, was just kind of another guy that he faced. He was another great golfer of his era. Gene Sarazen was another great golfer of his era. The guys that were legends on before he got there. Especially those British golfers, those were legends. They were all part of this opening up this story.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Kirkwood and Jim Barnes and all these other guys were legends of the time that he knew in this. So that's what I mean. Like he was an individual. He was a golfer. He was a golfing legend on his own right. He didn't need Bobby Jones to elevate him at all.
Right.
If anything, his participation in a match with Bobby Jones elevated him, if anything. But, I mean, Bobby Jones was already becoming a superstar at the time. He didn't really need Hagen. Yeah, but I'm just saying that Hagen has his own story, and it's really nice to be able to unpackage Hagen's story because we've seen how fascinating, in my opinion, how fascinating it is.
Bobby's a cute dude, though.
Yeah, man.
I can see why that sells magazines there.
So is Joe.
Little Tiger Beat 1927 there.
So is Jack Dempsey. Babe's not necessarily, but the Babe is like this eccentric, mashing home run hitter. But that's the thing is they could, they put this, picture, put him up on whatever picture, like, "Oh my God, Bobby Jones." They all love him. But anyways, so it is nice to be able to unpackage Hagen because once you do, you realize just how massive Walter Hagen was in his own right.
Yeah. All right, and we're going to dive deeper into it next time. Detroit City of Champions, the podcast. Like, subscribe, leave a comment. All those podcast things and all the podcast places, truly, absolutely appreciate it. Wearingfunny.com, very awesome t-shirts like this. If you're watching the video, you can Get to cool.
Haynes.com.
To get one. That's where it is. Wearingfunny.com.
Haynes.com to get the white tees.
All right. Like, subscribe, comment, all that stuff. Detroit City Champions, the podcast.